go. Are we starting?
Yes.
Anna?
Yeah, so I started already.
Oh, you started already.
Sorry, should I present you again?
No.
Okay.
By the way, how much time do I have? Should I go straight or have a break after a while?
Exactly. So this is perhaps a question to discuss. So how many of these people would like to go? So I don't know where. And, at 5, for example, at the APH or something. So if nobody, then I would suggest a break of 10 minutes, like 45 minutes. And a break. If somebody is urgent, he should be at the APH at 5, then we can do without break.
Okay.
No, we should.
But the lock is at 5:15.
5:15, yes.
So if we finish by 10 to 5, we're almost.
Okay, fine. So I'll go 50 minutes, minutes and then 10 minutes break. And, okay.
And then
so I have to say, so Anna invited me to talk and told me to talk for 6 hours, so I do what I'm told. And basically, 6 hours is more than I can prepare in advance, at once, okay? So basically I'll give a sequence of recycled talks and on occasionally maybe talk about something that isn't recycled, but at least the first talk is recycled from the future. So it's a talk that I prepared so as to give it a week from today in, or maybe 6 days from today in Bern. But still, it was prepared for a different purpose, and it was going to be a colloquium on the Kashiwara-Wern problem and topology. And so I hope you read the abstract by now. Basically, I will describe a general machine, completely general, that takes as inputs problems in topology, in fact, not even necessarily in topology, but let's pretend that in topology, produces as outputs problems in algebra, and I will give you one example of running this machine. So the input will be not theory in four dimensions, the output will be the Kashiwara-Wern problem, solved by Alexeyev and Meinranken, elucidated by Alexeyev and Torossian. And maybe I'll start by telling you what the Kashiwara-Wern conjecture was, when it was still a conjecture, now it's a theorem. So, I don't want to give you in details, the details, maybe later on, so within those 5 remaining hours that I will have, we will go through some of the details, and in fact it will be presented in a different language. This is the original conjecture as stated by Kashiwara and Wern, and the only thing I wanted to impress you with, that it's completely algebra, okay? And the subject is freely algebra. So the conjecture says there are 2 power series, F and G, or 2 elements in the freely algebra on 2 generators, X and Y. By the way, this is this is supposed to be informal. So you're more than welcome to interrupt me at any time, okay? So these are infinite linear combinations of free expressions made out of a bracket in a Lie algebra. So the only thing you mod out by is the Jacobi identity and the anti-symmetry of the bracket. And then these 2 elements, F and G, are supposed to satisfy 2 equations. One is written here, and again, I'm not sure I even want to interpret the things in here. The only thing I want to say is that it's a complicated algebraic equation written in the freely algebra itself. And then the second equation is that if z equals to the logarithm of e to the x times e to the y, again, in non-commutative settings, this is not simply x plus y, but rather a very complicated power series or a very complicated element of the freely algebra called the BCH element. And then with this z, a certain other equation is satisfied. Again, the only thing I want you to see is that it's a complicated equation. And within it appears phrases like trace, which I haven't defined, and a certain differential operator, which I haven't defined. But these things, these operations, turn this from an equation on trees, essentially, because the elements on the Frege algebra can be considered as trees, into an equation written in the language of cyclic words. So words that are written around along a circle instead of along a line. Okay? And then, again, with no detail whatsoever, I will just tell you that this conjecture implies a certain statement about convolutions, and the statement is actually a bit more intricate, but a loosely stated version of it is that convolutions on a Frege algebra, sorry, convolutions on a Lie algebra, so given a finite dimensional Lie algebra, convolutions of invariant functions on the Frege algebra agree with convolutions of invariant functions on the corresponding Lie group. So, in slightly more detail, a neighborhood of the identity of a Lie algebra is diffeomorphic to a neighborhood of the identity of the corresponding group. And then the claim is that if you have two functions supported in the neighborhood, in a small neighborhood of the identity in the Lie group, and you compute their convolutions, their convolution using the Haar measure on the group, then that's the same as pulling these functions back to the Lie algebra and computing the convolution using the Lebesgue measure on the Lie algebra. I should have said that this is for invariant functions. Okay? So, this is a loosely stated version of the theorem. The theorem has implications in representation theory. It's related to the coadjoint orbits, the orbit method in representation theory. And again, still completely loosely, without any details, how could such a theorem possibly be related to a statement about the Frege algebra. So again, very, very loosely, and maybe later I will give some details, but very, very loosely, you want to show that two integrals are equal. One integral written on the Lie algebra, another integral written on the Lie group. First of all, you pull these two integrals back to be on the same space. So you want to show that that one integral on the Lie algebra is equal to another integral on the Lie algebra. The way you do it is you find a measure preserving transformation that takes one integrand to the other integrand. And again, I'm a bit loose here. Okay? Now, how do you find a measure preserving transformation? Well, you have to find a formula for it. And the way you find a formula for it is you look for a universal formula that works in all Lie algebras. So such a universal formula can be written entirely in terms of the bracket, and it turns out that that formula is precisely what F and G do. It's a formula for the transformation that takes one integrand to the other. And then the first equation is the equation, is more or less the equation that says this formula indeed takes one integrand to the other. And the second formula is the formula that says that this, or is the, somehow encodes the requirement that this measure, that this transformation will actually be measure preserving. So this is somehow the Jacobian, or infinitesimally, the divergence of the measure-preserving transformation given by F and G. So, sorry, that was a two-minute introduction to Kashiwara-Verne. Again, more details hopefully later, depending on you, I suppose. Anyway, now the other side, and about the other side I plan to be a little more honest. So now the topology. So I claim that this conjecture is equivalent to a statement about topology using a certain machine, the machine I will describe later, but let me first describe the topology. So the topology is the topology of four-dimensional knots, and I want to tell you, to give you the story of four-dimensional knots in very, very few words. Okay? So here are a few examples for a start. Okay? So this is one of my favorite. It's from the book by Carter and Saito. And how do we interpret it as a four-dimensional knot? So first of all, we interpret it as a three-dimensional image, even though it's printed on a two-dimensional screen. We interpret it as a three-dimensional image the way we're used to interpret things. Okay, just we have this, we're born with this talent of seeing two-dimensional pictures and interpreting them three-dimensionally. But then add one dimension in the following way. So basically, all of this is embedded in one three-dimensional hyperplane or hyperspace in R4. Maybe we should call it the T equals zero hyperspace in R4. Except where there are gaps in the image. Wherever there is a gap in the image, it means that the corresponding thing dips into T less than zero. So here there is an annular gap in the image around this tube that goes in. So this means that momentarily the bottom of this drum dips down to below to T less than zero. Is this clear? So overall, what is this thing? I claim it's a knotted sphere. Okay, so let's follow it. Here is a tube. Let's follow it to the left. Well, first of all, it goes over, in the four-dimensional sense, a certain piece of plane. But then it goes further up. Well, you know, empties into this drum, which in itself empties in this direction, and which continues going over some other, well, other piece of the sphere, but some other two-dimensional object. Then it goes under some two-dimensional object, because the gap here is on the tubes that we're following, and then it closes by going over something else. So if I started here and went to the left, I saw a tube that closes. Now, if I start here and go to the right, well, I see a tube that goes under something, well, a place we've been before, but that's fine. Then it goes, then it inflates to become a drum, but to inflate, it goes above some other place where we've been before, and then the drum closes again while going over something else. But again, it's a tube that closes up. So that's one. So overall, this is a sphere, and believe me, it's knotted. Okay, are you with me? Here's another example of a four-dimensional knot. So you can't see it very well. So I've cut it in half. And it's actually, this is a surface, but I made it out of sort of bubble wrap, so it looks sort of bubbly, okay? But it's just a two-dimensional surface, and I've cut it in half, and to get from the half to the whole, you just add another copy on top. And here, the fourth dimension is encoded using color. So let's say that red is low, because in low places it's hot, and blue is high in the fourth dimension. And then when you trace this in, you find that over here, well, it appears singular, but it isn't, because it's red over green, red and green, and these are different heights in the fourth dimension. Likewise here, likewise here, likewise here. And again, so this is knotted, so this is an embedded thing in R4. It's clearly a sphere because, well, again, this is a tube which closes on both ends, so it's a sphere. And it may or may not be noted, but let me just make the following comment. Had this part of this sphere, so had this tube been entirely red, it would be unknotted. Because if this was entirely red, I could just slide green out. Okay? And then you can check that you can slide the other side as well. Okay? But it isn't. If you try to slide green out, you will have an intersection of this green with this green, and so at least superficially it appears knotted. Okay? By the way, these two knots are the same, but it's not at all obvious to see. Okay? And then my last example is a little video clip done by Esther Dalvit. And the other video clips later on are also by Esther Dalvit. So, you know, a different way of visualizing four dimensions is to say that you have, well, you cut the four-dimensional object, you slice it at different values of time, and then you have a movie of things flying around in R3. Now, these things generically are just one-dimensional manifold, because I took a two-dimensional thing and sliced it. One-dimensional manifolds are just spheres. Sorry, are just circles. So a four-dimensional knot, or at least a piece of a four-dimensional knot, can be visualized as a bunch of rings flying around in R3 and interacting, perhaps passing through each other or passing side by side. And this is this little video that Esther Dalvit produced. Let's hope it works. Dot, do you want to open or save? Open, it was supposed to be automatic. Oh, come on, sorry. So here is a bunch of flying rings in R3 interacting with each other and producing I suppose what is the analog, the four-dimensional analog of a braid. Here's a different thing. Here's a different representation of the same thing, where the t-coordinate was flipped with the z-coordinate. So, places where one ring went through the another become like pairs of cuts, like over here, okay? No further comments. I mean, I just wanted to show you these objects. Okay, now a bit more systematically. Are you still with me? Am I wasting your time?
It's great videos.
Okay, so now a bit more systematically. So, in fact, there is a two-dimensional representation of a big chunk of knot theory in four dimensions. So let me tell you what this two-dimensional presentation is. So it looks very much like ordinary knot theory, except the little objects mean different things. So in ordinary knot theory, we have a crossing. We also have a crossing in our story, but it means something else. Here are three different ways of understanding what it means. So one way is the flying rings way. So it's a pair of flying rings where one ring flies through the other. Okay? As hopefully illustrated by these five frames from a movie. Okay? Another way of visual of representing the same, a different projection of the same object is the one over here, which again should be interpreted three-dimensionally, again with the convention that wherever there is a gap, it means that something dips into t less than zero. Okay? So red is a tube that passes through blue without. And it appears singular, but there is no singularity, or there is no intersection, because momentarily blue dips to t less than zero over here, and red dips to t less than zero over here. And if you're unimpressed by this picture, let's see it spinning so that it will be easier to see. This should have been automatic. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, that's all. Maybe I'll move on to the next generator. The next generator does not exist in ordinary knot theory. I forgot one way of describing, yet another way of describing the same picture. So the other way is you first of all inflate each of these lines into a band with the convention that the upper strand gets inflated a bit more, so this band is a bit wider than this one, and furthermore, the lower band is sort of made to pass through the upper band in the way that this picture clearly represents. Okay? Now,
what? Omega weights, so what is this notation?
Oh, omega, so it's defined at the top of the handout. Omega is defined to be a certain URL, and if you go to omega slash x, you'll see this video.
Oh, okay.
Okay, thanks. Unrelated, this is not mathematical, it's a reference. Okay? So how is this interpreted? So now this is interpreted in three dimensions. To interpret it four dimensionally, do the following. Make two copies of the golden part, so of the membrane that fills in this band, and embed these two copies, one on top of each other, or at the same place in R3, the way this picture is showing, but then push one of them a little bit up in R4 using the fourth coordinate, and push the other one a little bit down in R4 while keeping their boundaries in R3, while keeping the brown lines always fixed. Okay? So do the pushing by an amount which is proportional to the distance from the boundary. Okay? Then, first of all, this band becomes a tube, right? Because it's two lines connected by two membranes that have been pushed up and down. This band also is a tube, just like these tubes over here. And furthermore, remember the convention that you push things up or down proportionally to their distance from the boundary. Since this tube is wider than that one, it gets pushed more, and so this apparent singularity here is not a real singularity in R4 because, well, in the fourth coordinate they differ. Okay? And if you think about it again a little bit, this is the same as that and the same as that. Okay. Then the next ingredient, which doesn't exist in ordinary knot theory, it's the virtual crossing, or a crossing without an indication of which one is over and which one is under. Okay, using the three method of visualizing, well, it's either a pair of flying rings that fly the trade places externally. So instead of flying one through the other, they just trade places externally. And of course, all ways of trading places externally are the same in R4. Alternatively, this is a pair of tubes in which one of the tubes passes, well, above on both on both sides. Okay, so then they can be separated, and again, all directions of separating them are the same. And yet another way of visualizing it is to see it as, well, the same inflation procedure as before, but where the two bands are, instead of going one through the other, they go one above the other. And again, it doesn't, in R3, it matters which one is above and which one is below. In R4, it doesn't. Okay? And then there are two further ingredients that I want to talk about. One is the cap, and I think the picture is clear. So basically it's a tube that gets capped at the end, and my two-dimensional notation for it will be a strand that ends in a bullet, okay? In a ball or whatever, a blob. And then the last piece is the three-dimensional, the four-dimensional vertex, or the plus vertex. And the plus vertex is actually a bit asymmetric, so the notation, the two-dimensional notation for it is made to be asymmetric. But what it is, four-dimensionally, and perhaps the easiest way to visualize it is to visualize it using the as a movie of flying rings. So it's a pair of flying rings that fly until they coincide with blue going under red, and then when they coincide, they merge into a single purple flying ring. Okay? So that's a singular vertex. At the time when they merge, this is not a manifold. This is similar to a vertex in of a one-dimensional thing in R3. So a vertex like this of a graph when embedded in R3 is singular at the point of the vertex. Here, the singularities, there is a circle word of singularities at this point, but otherwise it's more or less the analog of that. Okay? So now I told you what is the cast of things that I want to note in R4, and maybe I should just say that the things, or the bigger knots, are made out of these units by gluing them together. Okay? So, and I'll be a bit more formal about it in a minute. So, for example, if you take one crossing, another one crossing, and another virtual crossing, then using the dictionary from before, it becomes, well, each strand becomes a band. This band, the real crossings become band passing through each other, the virtual crossing becomes band passing one on top of each other, and then these bands are again inflated to make something in R4, and I think I'll skip the video, but this thing is the same as the video of flying rings that we saw before. Okay? And here's another example. This is sort of the analog of a long knot in ordinary knot theory. So a knot that goes from minus infinity to infinity, except now I'm allowing an extra ingredient. And when you inflate it one time, you get a band going from minus infinity to infinity with two honest crossings and one virtual. And when you inflate it a second time, you'll get a knotted tube in R4 embedded with sort of it's left with one end of the tube at minus infinity and the other end of the tube at plus infinity. Are you with me? Am I wasting your time? Am I going too slow? Okay. Oh, and sorry. One last example. So the knot that we saw right at the beginning using our presentation is this picture. So, well, actually, a line capped on both ends is just a two-dimensional sphere, and using the dictionary of before, this becomes that, and that is exactly what we had before. Are you with me? Okay, good. So now here is a formal definition of the space of knots I care about.
Sorry, so for me it looks like unknot.
No, because, yes. Because so far I described to you how to construct things, I didn't describe to you how you can move things.
So
I didn't tell you yet what are the Reidemeister moves. So you might want, so you know, if that was a line representing an ordinary knot, you would be able to pull this through, okay? But my rules of motions are different. You cannot pull a bullet over a strand. I will tell you what the rules of motion are in a minute, but you cannot pull a bullet over a strand because, I think I mentioned it before, but again, because, you know, using this sort of color coding by temperature, sorry, depth coding by color, by analogy with temperature, then, you know, here you have temperature zero because this is green, here you have negative temperature, here you have positive temperature. If you try to pull this out, well, by the intermediate value theorem, there's going to be some green point over here on the inner tube, and you just cannot do it without singularities. Okay? So, here is the story in terms of generators and relations. So, the space WK that I want to study, so W, maybe later I will say why, but this is W knots, and it really means a certain class of two-dimensional knots in R4, is the planar algebra generated by these planar pictures. So the overcrossing, the virtual crossing, the plus vertex, and also the minus vertex, which I didn't show, and the cup. And planar algebra, well, I could give a formal definition, but the formal definition is exactly what your intuition says, meaning you take these little pictures in the plane and you draw them more and more, you draw more and more of them side by side while connecting the lines to get bigger and bigger pictures in the plane. So essentially you will get precisely the pictures that I had over in the previous slide. Except you mod out by some relations, and all of these relations have a topological meaning. So you have a Reidemeister 2 moves, a Reidemeister 2 move for the honest crossing. You have a Reidemeister 3 move for involving three honest crossings. It's a lovely exercise to verify that these moves actually hold when these pictures are interpreted four-dimensionally using the recipes that I provided. I'll do it for only one of the relations at the end, okay? Then there is a Reidemeister 4 move for the vertices. So basically you can slide something under a vertex. And again, I mean all types of Reidemeister 4. So you can also slide a strand on top of a vertex, and also virtually through the vertex. So if these two crossings are virtual, you can still slide this to the other end and you'll have a virtual crossing on the other side. So really this is sort of three separate verifications. Okay? Then there is a virtual Reidemeister 1, a virtual Reidemeister 2, a virtual Reidemeister 3. So these are the same as the Reidemeister 2 and 3 of ordinary knot theory, except that you replace the crossings by virtual crossings. Then there is the mixed move, which says that if you have a strand passing virtually to the left of a crossing, you can slide it to the right of that crossing. There is the overcrossings commute, which says that if you have a strand that goes over the two strands that are involved in a virtual crossing, you can slide it so that it goes over those two strands, but on the right. And actually, an interesting part of this story is to see that the same relation actually does not hold if you flip over by under. So under crossings commute does not hold. If you have a strand that goes under two other strands which intersect virtually, you cannot slide it to the other side of the virtual intersection, and I don't know what this red line here is doing. It's a mistake. Okay? By the way, what's the sort of line ring interpretation of all of this? So, if you have a flying ring, so this ring will represent actually this one, okay, the one that goes over. So the two other ones have to go under it, which means through it in the flying ring picture. So if you have an over thing and you have two rings below it, they want to fly to the other side while trading places, but trading places externally. Okay? So, gee, I wish I could do it, but I'll do my best. So, okay, that was one way. So, first they traded places, then they flew through, and the other way is fly through and then fly further. Okay? And the two are clearly isotopic because you could just sort of slide the place where they trade places itself through the green ring. Okay? However, the other relation clearly does not hold.
This is an interpretation from left to right.
Yeah, I was reading it. Time here was flowing from left to right somehow. Yeah, and then the other, the undercrossings commute move, which looks more or less the same, but doesn't hold. And the reason here, well, now I have two large rings, right? So I have two rings that go over, this one and that one. They go over, so they are large, and one small ring that goes through them. So the statement is that if you have two large rings and one goes through them, then through the first and then through the second, this is not the same as going through the second and then through the first. Okay? And that's, well, no reason why it would be the same, and you cannot find a homotopy. Okay. Finally, there is the cup-pull relation. So if you have a cup, this is a cup, you can pull it under a strand, or if it goes virtually, you can pull the virtual crossing out. So it's these two relations. But again, the symmetric, or the if you replace over by under, this cup-pull relation fails. So you cannot pull a cup over a strand, as shown here. Okay, and we already discussed this. And then, you know, I think I'll skip the one, you know, in principle, each of these relations is proven by drawing something in R4, by visualizing something in R4. Here is one of those visualizations, a proof of relation M, but I hope you will believe me that it holds. Okay. Now, I told you about a piece of two-dimensional topology in R4, so of knot theory in R4, but this piece is more than just a collection of knots, but it's really a collection of things with an algebraic structure. There are operations as well as elements. The operations are, well, the obvious planar algebra operations. So, if you have two pictures made out of these ingredients, and these pictures live in two disks, so, I don't know, one picture will be, I say this one, and the other picture will be gee, I don't know what. This one, you can compose these two pictures. So both of these pictures are drawn in some disk, which really means that they live in some ball in R4. But anyway, you can glue these pictures by connecting the edges side by side. Okay? By putting these side by side and connecting the edges. It's not a single product. There isn't a single product operation here. It's many, 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 many different product operations that depend on basically an outer disk, an inner disk, and a list of ways how to connect the inner to the outer. Or a prescription how to connect the two inner ones to the outer. Whenever you have a picture like this, it represents a binary operation, because you could put a four-dimensional knot in here, put a four-dimensional knot in here, and you'll get the picture representing a four-dimensional knot overall. Okay? So that's what a planar algebra means. It has many, many multiplications, and they correspond to pictures of this nature. But then there are two further operations that I want you to consider. So one is the operation that takes a vertex, which is capped, into a pair of capped capped strands. Now, what does it mean four-dimensionally? So, four-dimensionally, you know, you have two tubes that meet in a singular way and become a single tube, which in itself get capped at the end. But this singular tube, you can think of it as, or you can replace it by two parallel membranes that run precisely along each other, and one caps the original tube, the left tube, and the other one caps the right tube. So this is the so-called disk and zip operation, because what we had here, so this the part here on the top is really a disk, and what we did is we replaced this disk by two parallel disks that cap the two, well, sides of the two tubes that flew into this picture. And then similarly, there is an annulus and zip operation. So if you have two vertices, and forget the sand, but if you have two vertices that are connected to each other by a strand, well, topologically, this is two rings that fly and coincide, and they fly together for a while, and then they break up again. I could replace it by two rings that fly until they're nearby, and then fly together for a while, not merged, without being merged, just by being near each other, and then fly away. Okay? So, topologically, I took a tube and replaced it by two parallel tubes, one inner to the other by just a little bit, and also desingularized the two vertices. Okay? So now I have this big algebraic structure. Four-dimensional knots with many, many, many binary operations, and also two types of unary operations, the disk and zip and the annulus and zip. And these operations take knots to other knots. Okay, I'm done describing the topology side, and now I have to tell you about the general machine that takes topology to algebra.
Just a stupid question. Why you don't use a three-valent vertex for your generator and you
Sorry?
Why don't you use a three-valent vertex for the generator? and you interrupt one line.
No, I did use it. This is a, oh, why did I interrupt one line?
Yeah.
This is a part of the vertex. It's just a way of indicating the fact that the vertex is a little bit asymmetric. Because in this vertex, the sort of when two things merge, you have to specify which one comes from below and which one comes from above. So this is, it's just a way to indicate that this vertex is slightly asymmetric. Okay, anyway, back to algebra, and I'm going to describe a machine that takes, well, one type of algebraic problems to another type of algebraic problems. Okay? So, forget for a minute about four-dimensional topology. Okay? So, let G be a group. Really, a group is a set with a binary operation. Everything that I will do below has a meaning also when you talk about a set with many binary and unary operations. So this is sort of just a simple case of what I will really use, what I will really do. So let G be a group, let K be the group ring of the group G, meaning the collection of all finite formal linear combinations of elements of the group, and let I be the augmentation ideal. So it's the ideal within K of linear combinations for which the sum of coefficients is equal to zero. Let A be the associated graded of K. So this is the infinite direct sum, or the completed infinite direct sum, of quotients of the form, take this ideal to the nth power and mod it out by the n plus first power. This sequence of ideals, I to the n is nested, I to the n plus 1 is contained in I to the n, so it makes sense to look at this quotient. You can check that the product on G, or more precisely the product on or the product on K, induces a product on K on A. So K was an algebra, and so is A. And now I'm going to define to make what appears to be a completely ad hoc definition, but then I'll tell you that it's interesting. So the definition: a linear map Z from K to A is called an expansion if it has the following property. For every gamma in the nth power of the ideal, if you compute Z of gamma, so the nth power of the ideal is a part of K, so you can compute Z of any elements in any such gamma, and the output will be in A. But A is a set of infinite sequences of elements in which the nth one is in I to the n modulo I to the n plus 1. So the condition for being an expansion is that Z of gamma should be 0 up to degree m. In degree m, you should see gamma itself, except considered inside this quotient. So the equivalence class of gamma modulo I m plus 1. And beyond that, I just don't care what you see. So that's an expansion. And a homomorphic expansion is an expansion, so a map from K to A, that satisfies this property, but in addition, respects the algebraic structure of both sides. So K is an algebra, A is an algebra, I want it to be multiplicative. Okay? So, you know, this may look weird, so let me show you two examples. So, first example, well, it's not quite a group ring, but it's sufficiently similar. So let K be the ring of C infinity functions on Rn, and let I be the ideal of functions that vanish at zero. Then, by the way, I'm running out of time, but the talk was designed for an hour, so maybe I will take 10 more minutes, and then we'll take a shorter break. And then we'll take a break. Okay? So I is the function that vanish at zero. It's clearly an ideal. I to the m will be functions that vanish m times, right? I to the m will be products of m functions that vanish once. So these will be functions that vanish like x to the m. Now, if you look at functions that vanish m times, and you don't care about lower order terms, what you're left with is polynomial of degree n. Polynomial of degree n, right? And so A, the direct sum, or the complete direct sum, of the space of all polynomials of degree m, is the space of all power series. So, an expansion will be a map Z from C infinity functions to power series. And in fact, there are plenty of examples, but the most natural one is the Taylor expansion. So it's the map that maps functions to the Taylor power series computed at zero. Okay? And you can check that the Taylor power series, in fact, is a homomorphic expansion, because the Taylor expansion of a product of two functions is the product in the appropriate sense of the two Taylor expansions. So, in some sense, this definition here says that the notion of Taylor series makes sense in a completely general algebraic, even non-commutative context, because I didn't even ever say that the group G here should be commutative. Okay. Just for fun, and I'll do it really quickly, here is another example of what an expansion means. So, let K be the set of all two-dimensional pictures. So I suppose two-dimensional projections of reality. So I suppose these are functions from a rectangle, into R3, because for each point you have to specify the three colors, red, green, and blue, the brightness of the three colors, okay? I think I don't want to tell you what the sequence of quotients is, so I don't want to tell you what the ideals are or what the filtration is, but basically, with very little detail, K3 would be the thing for which, if you mod K by K3, you don't see the difference between points that are in the same subrectangle of this size of the original picture. So then, if you look at the quotients K modulo K1, you just see it's as if you're looking from very far away and the whole picture looks like a single dot. If you look at K mod K4, it gets less and less pixelated. You get to see less and less pixelated, which means that you get to see something closer and closer to the original. There is an obvious projection from K to K modulo each of these subspaces, and the associated graded will be this direct sum of Km modulo the next Km, and you can think of it as the information that is contained in this picture. Sorry, so K3 modulo K4 would be the information that is contained in this picture, which isn't already in this picture. And then an expansion would be a way to transmit the information of the original picture, so that you first transmit only what you need here, then you transmit what you need here, disregarding without retransmitting what you've transmitted before, and so on. And you know, if you remember the old times when the web was slow, JPEG pictures would sort of gradually appear and become less and less pixelated. Essentially, it's because somebody had chosen an expansion for the space of images, for the set of images. And then finally, the set of images has various operations defined on it. So crop, rotate, putting two images side by side, and you might want an expansion to be compatible with these operations, and that's a homomorphic expansion. Sorry, this is completely loose and only for the purpose of entertainment. So an expansion is somehow a way of viewing something progressively in an inductive way. And then the purpose, if you wish, of this sequence of talks is to explain this theorem, which appears in a paper with Zhuzhana Dancho and also at this URL. So the claim is that finding a homomorphic expansion for the collection of four-dimensional knots that I talked about before. Now, what does it mean? So it means do the exact same procedure as before. So first of all, allow yourself linear combinations. So look at the group ring. So allow yourself a formal linear combinations of such knots. Within formal linear combinations of such knots, there is the ideal of formal linear combinations in which all the coefficients, in which the sum of the coefficients is equal to zero. This is an ideal with respect to all operations. So we have a large collection of operations. You can check that this augmentation ideal here satisfies the ideal property with respect to all of these operations. Furthermore, it makes sense to look at powers. So take two elements of this ideal, one bound in one disk, then another one bound in another disk, look at their planar algebra composition, and you got an element in a bigger disk which can be considered as lying inside the ideal square, because it's a binary operation applied to two elements of the ideal. So the notion I to the m makes sense, these iterated quotients make sense, the notion of an expansion makes sense just as well. And then the theorem is that finding a homomorphic expansion is precisely equivalent to the Kashiwara-Verne problem, and more precisely, there is a bijection between the set of homomorphic expansions and the set of solutions of the Kashiwara-Verne problem. And I have to say two things. First of all, I have to tell you about the proof. So I have to, you know, so far it's a statement, but I have to justify it. I have to explain why, how the associated graded of that space that appears in knot theory is somehow related to Lie algebras. Okay? And then hopefully prove this theorem. And the second thing that I want to state is that this is the tip of a major iceberg. So there are many other similar knot theoretic or topological algebraic structures. So algebraic structures in which the elements are knots or other topological things, and in a similar way, they get related to other pieces of algebra. And again, with luck, I will be able to tell you about a few more of those. Okay? So, yeah, I think let's take a 10 minutes break.